Welcome to the Press On Podcast. Expect to be inspired, challenged, and strengthened. In this episode, we'll hear from Tom Gaston on the morality of sex.
In this series, we have been thinking afresh about Christian attitudes to sex. In the first article, I explored the reasons why some Christians may put a disproportionate emphasis on sexual matters. Then, in the second article, I sought to present a more balanced view of sex. Both of these articles have intentionally avoided the morality of sex and how we judge whether certain acts are right or wrong. Now, in this third article, I want to think about the underpinnings of a Christian morality of sex. In the 1960s, there was a sexual revolution in the West, which saw a dramatic change in attitudes to sex. Many in wider society saw this as a liberation, giving individuals far greater freedom and autonomy. It also changed social attitudes to sex, leading to the normalization of contraception, pornography, premarital sex, and homosexuality. These changes were predicated on the view that the key moral values are avoiding harm to others and respecting personal autonomy, which, in the area of sexual ethics, are generally condensed to the principle of consent. Today, the overarching principle governing sexual relationships is that whatever consenting adults do is fine. We should not minimize the importance of consent. Indeed, understood correctly, consent has its origins in the Christian worldview. You wouldn't respect the consent of somebody unless you also recognized their moral status. In the Roman world, consent was not seen as important or necessary. The rich and powerful had sex with whoever they wanted, especially slaves, who, of course, had no say. Christianity changed this ethos. We are all one in Christ, regardless of race or sex or status. Yet Paul clearly had an uphill challenge with new converts overcoming their societal expectations around sex. He writes, "Since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife and each woman with her own husband." The clear implication being that this was not common practice. Indeed, within marriage, Paul has to introduce the concept of mutual consent. Yes, for periods of abstinence, but also, by implication, for the opposite. We should not mistake Paul's meaning when he says the wife does not have authority over her own body. He does not mean consent is not required, since the principle applies to both parties. Paul means that they have a responsibility to each other. This is one of the shortcomings of consent. One might extract consent from somebody without showing responsibility to that person and their needs or wishes. The radical idea that Christianity unleashed on the Roman world was that all humans were created in the image of God, including women and slaves. It is unfortunate, then, that secular society today often focuses on consent to the exclusion of other moral values. Consent is incredibly important. But emphasizing just this one principle has some unfortunate consequences. Firstly, if the only relevant moral principle is consent, then sex has no special value in and of itself. It'd be no more special than sharing a cup of tea or a game of tennis. Yet most people behave as though sex does have special value. One of the reasons that sexual assault is taken so seriously is because we preserve the belief that sex is more special than other acts. We wouldn't see non-consensual tennis in the same way. Secondly, consent is quite thin soup when it comes to something as highly charged as sex. You can consent to something that you don't want, or that you later regret, or that isn't in your best interests. Social or peer expectations can motivate someone to give consent contrary to their own preferences or ideals. Consent puts the full responsibility on the individual to protect their own well-being and their own wishes. Thirdly, focusing on consent alone erodes the significance of other moral virtues. An alarming number of women die each year during sex involving strangulation. In most cases, the man is not prosecuted because he can assert that the act was consensual. And how could the criminal justice system prove otherwise? Yet if we assume that the full and willing consent was given, There seems something deeply troubling about the idea that someone could take sexual pleasure from simulating violence against their partner. Taking pleasure in violence is not a virtue. It is the opposite. Limiting the principles of sexual morals to consent ignores the central basis of morality, the inner man, the conscience, the heart. Today's secular morality of sex seems insufficient to express the value that many of us feel that it has. Instead, we should look to a Christian morality of sex. On the face of it, the Bible might seem a strange place to go for moral guidance about sex. Particularly in the Old Testament, many of the characters exhibit behaviors that would shock modern Christian sensibilities. Abraham married his half-sister. Many of the main characters had multiple wives, including Abraham, Moses, and David. In addition to multiple wives, Old Testament characters seem to think nothing of also having concubines, that is, women who did not have the status of a wife, but nevertheless that men slept with. Again, including Abraham, Gideon, and David. This is not to mention the 700 wives and 300 concubines of Solomon. The way that Sarah gives Hagar to Abraham to sleep with, and Leah and Rachel give Bilhah and Zilpah to Jacob, is indicative of the lack of control female slaves had over their own bodies. Samson went in to a prostitute. Judah slept with Tamar, thinking she was a prostitute, and seemingly was so unembarrassed by that transaction that he sent his servant back later to settle up. Indeed, Tamar is described by Judah as more righteous, despite the circumstances, because the governing moral principle of this story is that a widow should marry her dead husband's brother. These stories are not recorded in the Bible as examples for us to follow. Unlike the parables of Jesus, these stories do not conclude with the injunction, "Go and do likewise." The law of Moses, whilst prohibiting some of these behaviours, such as incest, also doesn't seem well suited as a guide for Christian morality of sex. Polygamy was not forbidden, but regulated, securing the rights of the first wife to food, clothing, and marital rights, and securing the rights of sons of both wives. Divorce also was not restricted, but regulated. Both men and women were forbidden to become shrine prostitutes, and normal prostitutes are detested. On the other hand, there are no regulations in the law of Moses about weddings or marriage. Women have little autonomy. Daughters are given in marriage by their fathers in return for the bride price. There is some measure of protection from those laws that forbid a man to divorce his wife on false accusations, yet an unmarried woman who is raped is forced to marry her rapist. Female slaves are not afforded the same protections as free women. Women enslaved from other nations have the lowest status of all. If an Israelite wants to take such a wife, he can. The law of Moses regulates a lot of the excesses of this period, forbidding many of the sexual practices of the surrounding nations, but falls short of a Christian view of marriage. In relation to divorce, Jesus said that Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard, implying that such permission was a concession rather than an ideal. Perhaps the other commandments of the law of Moses should be regarded in the same way, as concessions to cultural context rather than God's true intent. We cannot base a Christian morality of sex either on the stories or the commandments in the Old Testament, but it would be a mistake to view the New Testament as just a better set of commandments that nullify and supersede those of the Old. This is not the way that the Scriptures functioned for the Christian, nor the way that Christian morality is founded. Whilst the Bible is sometimes presented by Christians as a guidebook for life, the truth is that it doesn't operate in that way. You cannot simply turn up the section on sex and get a complete and robust sexual ethic. The Bible isn't that sort of book. The Bible is a collection of books telling the story of God's relationship with the nation of Israel, building to his revelation in Jesus Christ. These histories are not intended as patterns to live by, nor are the commandments intended to be definitive answers to complex moral problems. In fact, I think it's really important that the Bible does not give predefined answers to every moral question, because I think that God desires something richer and more significant for his children. In the study of ethics, or moral philosophy, the different approaches to morality are usually split into three categories: consequentialism, deontology, and virtue ethics. These categories are defined by the key concept that these approaches, different approaches, take to determine what is right and what is wrong. Consequentialism assesses moral actions with regards to their consequences. Deontology focuses on rules and duties, and virtue ethics focuses on the virtues through which those actions are undertaken. Everyone will intuitively want to give some thought to consequences in relation to their actions. In general, we might expect that good actions to have better consequences than bad ones. But determining right and wrong purely with regard to consequences leads to results that run counter to our moral intuitions. The most common form of consequentialism is utilitarianism, whose maxim is the greatest good for the greatest number. However, such an approach risks treating individuals as a means to an end, and may run counter to the best interests of minorities in pursuit of better consequences for the majority. Our moral intuitions, or perhaps our ingrained Christian values, posit that all human beings have an innate moral dignity and worth. These intuitions would run counter to a utilitarian approach. We do not find the Bible framing moral decisions through a consequentialist lens. In contrast to consequentialism, deontology might prevent people being treated as a means to an end because it assesses moral actions through rules and duties that would apply universally. On the other hand, attempting to define rules, principles, and duties that apply in every case and yet are flexible enough to adapt to the nuances of every case is complicated. For example, Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative, that we should behave in such a way that you could wish your actions were to become a universal law, seems to run into many counterexamples of actions that seem benign, and yet that I can't wish to become a universal law. For example, I don't want everyone to go to the same restaurant as me on the same evening as me. One form of deontology is divine command theory, the view that the origin of moral duties is divine commands. Given that the Bible contains a lot of commands, we might understand the appeal of divine command theory. And yet it is also obvious that the rules in the Bible are not straightforwardly a set of universally applicable and unchanging divine commands. There are many rules in the Bible that Christians simply do not follow. For example, immediately after the commandment to love your neighbor as yourself, we find the commandment to not wear clothing woven of two kinds of material, a commandment I am breaking even as I speak to you. Furthermore, it is not obvious that the rules in the Bible form an exhaustive moral program, since there are lots of topics not specifically addressed. I think when you look at the teaching of Jesus, he seems to take a different approach. Jesus is very critical of the rule-based approach of the Pharisees, the religious leaders of his own day. In Matthew 23, he gives a long list of criticisms of the Pharisees and their approach. He says, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, and yet you neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former." The Pharisees were so intent on keeping every rule exactly that they would even measure out a tenth of their herbs and spices to donate to the temple to make sure that they were keeping the rule. And yet Jesus says they were neglecting justice, mercy, and faithfulness. Keeping to the strict letter of the law had blinded the Pharisees from what was really important, virtues like mercy and faithfulness. Jesus makes the same point elsewhere. In Matthew 15, there is the incident where the Pharisees criticize Jesus because he allows the disciples to eat without first washing, breaking one of their rules. In response, Jesus quotes the words of Isaiah to them. "These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are mere human rules." For Jesus, the important point was not whether you kept the rules or not. The important thing was where your heart is. The hearts of the Pharisees were far from God. Later in the same chapter, he says this, "Don't you see that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and then out of the body? But the things that come out of a person's mouth come from the heart, and these defile them. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false testimony, slander. These are what defile a person, but eating with unwashed hands does not defile them." It's important to see the contrast here between the rules-based approach and the teaching of Jesus. In the Law of Moses, there is page after page of rules about what you can and can't eat. Rules upon rules about foods that make you unclean, foods that defile. Yet here, Jesus says that whatever you eat just goes into your stomach and then out again. It has no moral effect on you. You are not defiled by the foods that you eat. Jesus says that the bad things come from your own heart. It is evil thoughts in the heart that are the source of the problem. Again and again in the teaching of Jesus, we find him referring to the heart as the source of moral action, as the source of right and wrong. Think about these words from Jesus in Luke 6. "No tree bears bad fruit. No good tree bears bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. Each tree is recognized by its own fruit. People do not pick figs from thorn bushes or grapes from briars. A good man brings good things out of the good stored in his heart, and an evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored in his heart. For the mouth speaks what the heart is full of." His point is that good actions and evil actions all come from the heart. If your heart is full of good, then that will result in good actions. But if your heart is full of evil, then that will result in evil actions. Of course, for most of us, our hearts are a mix of both. This is why careful examination of our motives is so important when making complex moral decisions. The teaching of Jesus, then, is about the intentions of the heart. It's about virtues. The difference in Jesus' approach to right and wrong is probably seen most clearly in his approach to the Sabbath. The Law of Moses had very clear rules about the Sabbath. Exodus 20 says, "Remember the Sabbath by keeping it holy. 6 days shall you labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work." In fact, this rule was so important that there were very strict punishments for those who broke it. But Jesus has a different approach. In Matthew 12, we read about how the disciples were walking through a field on the Sabbath and plucked some grain to eat. The Pharisees complained to Jesus about this because they considered it to be work which would be breaking the commandments of the Sabbath. Jesus responds, quoting the words of Hosea, saying, "If you had known what these words mean, 'I desire mercy, not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent." This response is so telling because the disciples had broken the letter of the law. The disciples had worked on the Sabbath. But Jesus prioritizes virtues like mercy over keeping the rules. He declares the disciples to be innocent, despite their breach of the command, because their act had no evil intent. Again, in Mark 3, we read how Jesus was teaching in the synagogue when a man with a disabled hand came in. The account says that some were closely watching Jesus to see whether he would heal the man, because that would be work and would be breaking the Sabbath. For Jesus, these onlookers had completely the wrong priorities. He says to the crowd, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" The implication of Jesus' question is that the right thing to do is to do good. Hence, Jesus heals the man. Jesus' question illustrates the difference between a rules-based approach and a virtues-based approach. The commandment for bad working on the Sabbath, if that commandment is meant to apply in every case without exception, then healing someone on the Sabbath would be wrong. Yet Jesus says that healing is the right thing to do. Doing good is more important than keeping the rules. Your actions should be guided by the good intentions of your heart, not by the rules. If this is true, then it has a profound effect on how we should think about moral issues, including the morality of sex. Rather than trying to codify rules to govern our actions from various statements in Scripture, we should be trying to understand what virtues are important to our Heavenly Father. Rather than focusing on the interpretation of disputed words, we should be looking to the values taught in Scripture and to the character of Jesus to shape our hearts into those that are ready to do good works. This is not to say that an approach to morality based around virtues, or the heart, to use Jesus' terminology, will ignore consequences or other ideas. Something must give content to our moral thinking. But what defines an action as good or bad is not whether it has bad consequences or whether it breaks a rule, but whether it is done from a good motive, from a character that reflects the character of God. A virtue is a positive character trait. For Christians, virtues take their pattern from the character of God, particularly as revealed to us in the person of Jesus. Put more simply, for Christians, morality is a matter of mirroring the character of Jesus. There are many such Christian virtues, like humility and compassion, that we find modeled for us in the person of Jesus. For our purposes here, I want to sketch out some of the Christian virtues relevant to the morality of sex. First of these is reverence. This respect for God should lead us to honour his intentions and his purposes. As we explored in previous articles, sex is a gift from God, a blessing to be enjoyed with thanksgiving. Furthermore, if, as I have proposed, sex was given by God for the purpose of relationship formation, then this tells against the idea of casual sex or physical intimacy divorced from emotional intimacy. Then there is respect, a full respect for others as full persons made in the image of God. The radical equality of moral worth implied by this concept is at the heart of the commandment to love your neighbour as yourself and of Jesus' injunction to do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. What lies behind these commandments is the recognition of the full humanity of the other. As we saw in a previous article, we are embodied persons. Our bodies are part of who we are. Therefore, to treat someone as just a body is an insult to them and to their creator. To treat someone as an object denies their personhood altogether. Respecting their full personhood, to treat somebody as you would like to be treated, means thinking about their full well-being, physical and emotional and spiritual. Just because someone might not be physically harmed by sexual intercourse does not mean it is in their interests, but to engage in an act against someone's interests is not moral. Lastly, I would mention faithfulness. This is one of the key characteristics of God as revealed in the Bible. It's also one of the fruits of the Spirit. Jesus warns us against making oaths because Christians should not need oaths to keep them truthful. Faithfulness means keeping the commitments you've made and staying true to your word. More than this, faithfulness means commitment that transcends just the promises articulated in words. Of course, faithfulness in marriage is not just about sexual fidelity. For example, financial fidelity is also important. But Christian sexual relationships will be founded on commitment. There are other virtues that we could explore. But with these three, we can begin to see the shape and scope of a Christian morality of sex, which entails that sexual intercourse would only be enacted in the consequence of a committed relationship based upon a mutual respect for the other and for their well-being. To add one caveat, whilst love is a Christian virtue, being in love is not. We are not well served in English by having one word, love, that has such a wide semantic field, being used of a great spectrum of different concepts. Being in love is not bad or wrong. It is natural and involuntary. But it should not be mistaken for the virtue of love, and certainly cannot be taken to inform moral decision-making. If anything, the power and intensity of that feeling of being in love risks blinding us to genuine virtues that should be guiding our actions. Christian love should be shown to all people. When I was a teenager, Perhaps the most common question my contemporary Christadelphians would ask was, how far can I go with my girlfriend slash boyfriend before marriage? It's an understandable question. The problem with the question is that it assumes a rules-based approach to Christian morality. The question assumes that there is a rule, i.e. no sex before marriage, and is in effect requesting an adjudication on whether this rule includes or excludes kissing, petting, non-penetrative sex, etc. Now, of course, there is no explicit rule in the scriptures saying no sex before marriage, though it is implied, and certainly there are no rules on other premarital behaviours. This is because the concept of dating is a modern notion. For many of the characters in the Old Testament, becoming husband and wife seemed like it was a fairly instantaneous process. For Isaac, taking Rebecca into his mother's tent seems to have been enough. For a first century Jew, they probably would have been married as teenagers, and their marriage would have been arranged. If a young woman, like Mary, was betrothed, this does not mean that she was in a romantic relationship, dating, with Joseph. Betrothal was as binding as marriage. All that remained was for her to move from her father's house into the house of her husband. The idea of spending months or years in a romantic relationship before deciding to get married or not was just not the practice. So the question of how far can I go would not have arisen. Indeed, the question of falling in love with somebody was basically irrelevant since your spouse was chosen by your parents. But today, in affluent countries at least, many young people will not finish full-time education till their early 20s and may not be in a position to afford to rent accommodation of their own until later still. This means that marriage is considerably delayed in comparison to first century practice. Young Christians might meet their future spouse as teenagers and yet may wait many years until marriage and thus consummation. The Apostle Paul would likely have been pragmatic on this point. He says to the Corinthians, "It is better to marry than burn with passion." We, as a community, might reflect on whether we should be encouraging our young people to marry as soon as they're ready, regardless of the norms of wider society, or indeed the perceived necessities of adult independence. Why should a young couple wait until after university or until they have a house of their own? Indeed, why should they wait 18 months to first plan a massive wedding? All those things could come after, as desired, but that need not prevent the actual marriage starting much, much sooner. However, this line of thinking is still operating on a rules-based approach, looking for clear binary markers that can be used to denote the sinfulness or otherwise of a particular action. There is a risk that we treat marriage as such a marker, with the implication that by ticking off that ceremony is the thing that determines the rightness of sexual intercourse. But a virtues-based approach, which we find in the teaching of Jesus, should guide us to look to our motives behind our actions and the virtues with which they are rooted. The question of whether to have sex, or indeed engage in any non-penetrative erotic behaviour, should be answered by our motives and by our character, even within marriage. Am I simply seeking self-gratification apart from emotional intimacy and commitment? Or am I motivated by the full reciprocal respect for my partner and their well-being? I suspect many Christian couples will continue to see marriage as an important moment of transition in their relationships as they publicly and legally express their commitment to each other. And though conducting marriages was not always part of the function of churches, marriage only became a sacrament of the church in 1164, there is something valuable in the expression of commitment before God and within the church community. Nevertheless, for the Christian, the operative issue is virtues like commitment and fidelity, and how those find expression for Christian couples may differ across circumstances. This virtues-based approach is not a license for self-indulgence, but places greater responsibility on the Christian to act in a way that is consistent with the character modelled for them by their master. There is something troublingly deficient about the sexual morality of today's secular society. Focusing on consent alone as the key moral principle governing sexual relationships fails to do justice to the significance of sex and risks real harms, both emotional and physical. Christianity offers a deeper and richer morality of sex that requires consideration and respect for the well-being of the other person. The precondition of sexual intercourse is not just consent, but reciprocal desire and reciprocal benefit expressed through commitment and fidelity. This morality is not based upon rules in the way that crude caricatures of Christians are often portrayed, but based upon virtues that seek to emulate the character of God as revealed to us through the person of Jesus. The Bible does not present us with a rule for every moral decision, and it is a mistake to try and fit the Bible into such a framework. Instead, the Bible guides us to forming virtuous characters that inform our moral decision-making, despite the differing circumstances and different scenarios that we find ourselves in. This is true of the changing circumstances and scenarios of sexual behaviours today. We do not have rules to follow suited to every case, but instead it is virtues like reverence for God, respect for others, and faithfulness that guide us in what we should do.
Thanks for joining us on the Press On podcast. You've been listening to Tom Gaston. For more, visit pressonjournal.org.